next guest is the gentleman who shredded the guitar on that track. Jimmy Ryan is an American artist, composer, producer, arranger, and author. His career has spanned over 60 years and is still going strong. He started with his college band when he was 19. He played for the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. Also, he played on that track and several others for Carly Simon. He has recorded with basically everybody from James Taylor to The Doors and all points in between. I am delighted to welcome onto the show, because he's put it all down in a book called Behind, the Autobiography of a Musical Shapeshifter, the one, the only Jimmy Ryan. Jimmy, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world.
And whereabouts in the world are you today, Jimmy? Where do we find you?
I'm in the middle of the United States. I'm in a state called Iowa. Tiny little, I call it a boutique town because it's so different from the rest of Iowa, which is basically cornfields, but it's a little college town, lots of artists, coffee shops, you know, fun little place, and quite an international population. We moved here because I was living in the East Coast of New York, and New York is just insane. Let's face it, New York, I'm going to sit here, I'm going to tell you, New York is just nuts. There's just too many people there, and there was no reason for me to be there anymore. You know, I wasn't doing live guitar sessions in the latter part of my career. The last 20 years, I've been scoring for TV and films and stuff like that, which required me being in New York. Well, now with the internet, you know, I can send an MP3 of what I've done to somebody, and they'll have it in 1 second, make comments, I'll fix whatever they want, send them that, and there's the soundtrack. So I can do that from Alaska. I can do that from, you know, Antarctica.
And then also, because, I mean, your career has taken you, you know, to New York, to, you were in London for a while as well, weren't you? You spent a lot of time in London.
For about 4 or 5 years, yeah. I loved London, boy. Didn't want to move from there. But, you know, I wondered what I was going to say about that, because I knew you, you know, my publisher is, of course, a British publisher. And the situation was, I was very busy. I was doing a lot of sessions, but I couldn't make a living, because musicians make less money than the guy who cleans the waste baskets. I don't know. You know, that was certainly what it was in the time. So I was there while it was fun, you know, dating the British girls and having a great time, and, you know, all that. But eventually, you know, even though busy, I had to make a living. So I came back to New York.
So all kicked off in the early 60s with a band called The Critters. And you were kind of successful straight off the box, weren't you?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
You were sort of your first band, The Critters, I believe it was, and you had a couple of top 40 hits, you know, quite soon in your musical trajectory, as it were.
Oh my God, yeah, I was. I think the first hit, I was 17 years old. It was completely intentional. I mean, for me, it was playing sock hops and playing at the drive-in theater and stuff like that. But then a guy joined the band, a guy named Don Ciccone, who eventually went on to be one of the Four Seasons. Joined the band, and he was all ambition, and we were all for it, because, you know, we just didn't have the drive, and he did. So he got us thinking along, like, well, come on, let's get a record deal. And I'm like, a record deal? Well, he said, well, I've written a song. And so we listened to a song. All right, that's fine. We did an audition for Music Chords, a small label in New York. They loved us. We cut the record. It totally bombed. I can give you the whole history of this thing. I'll try and do it quickly. But at that point, we became a house band for a big music hall that showcased very big artists. And we became the backups for the Ronettes, for Little Anthony and the Imperials, you know, bands like Jay and the Americans. Jay's girlfriend, Jay Black of Jay and the Americans, loved us. And she said, have you guys ever had a record deal? And we said, yeah, we just got dropped by a record company. She goes, oh, no. That's never going to happen again. Her boss worked at Kama Sutra, the Loving Spoonfuls label. She snuck an appointment into his appointment book while he wasn't looking. And when the day came along, she said to him, hey, don't forget that appointment to listen to The Critters. And he says, the who? What? What are you talking about? I said, oh, Frank, come on. You told me to put it in your date book. You told me you wanted to audition this band that everyone's talking about. And he said, well, I guess if I told you so, all right. So he came and auditioned us. He loved us. They signed us. And that brought you Younger Girl, Mr. Dyingly Sad, Don't Let the Rain Fall Down on Me. It was a long, very successful working relationship. So that put me on the map.
And presumably, you know, being the backing band for all these groups, I mean, by this point, you know, the critics were quite tight. You knew, you know, what everybody was doing, because you were performing behind different people on a regular basis.
Exactly. Well, everybody in the band played by ear. I mean, we, even at that stage, we were all huge fans of pop music and rock and R&B and all that. So we listened to the radio and we learned our instruments listening to the radio. I had guitar teachers, but they were teaching me, you know, and I just, I hated it. I did my lessons because my parents wanted me to. The minute I was done, I turned the radio, started listening. Oh, what's that chord? What's that? Oh, Buddy Holly. What's he doing there? So I did what they call woodshedding. You know, that's an expression that means you go out in the woodshed and you don't come out, you practice, but you don't come back out until you're good. So that the woodshed was my bedroom, and all the guys in the band were like that. We all just listened. So when somebody like the Ronettes comes along, we already know their songs. You know, we knew Be My Baby. We knew what Walking in the Rain. It was just a matter of sitting down with Ronnie and her sister and her cousin. And all right, what key you want to do this in? You want to lower it a little bit today? No, we'll do it in the original key. It was great. And play along. And there you go.
This was the mid 60s. You know, the 60s sort of obviously progressed and Vietnam happened. And it affected your band in a different way, because wasn't it true that the guys got drafted?
Oh, God. Now we come to the sad chapter. The first one to go was Bob. He played melodica, that kind of thing you blow in with a keyboard on it. The Hooters made it very famous in their band. And he was a backup singer and percussionist and an excellent saxophonist. We were all going to Villanova University, three of us, actually. And he was in, I believe, physics or chemistry or something like that. It was just more than he can handle. So he dropped out and immediately got classified 1A, which is the American classification for you're going to war. You know, that's the one. I was 2S, which is the student deferment. They don't bother you as long as you stay in college. So rather than get drafted, he joined the Air Force, which made the two-year draft turn into 4 years when you enlist. So he was gone forever. Next, Don Ciccone, who was my roommate and the writer of Mr. Dying They Sad and our lead singer, he made it about a year and a half. And after that, he started flunking everything. So he dropped out to be a full-time musician until they changed his draft status. Now he had to do something faster. He'd be on the front lines in Vietnam. So he joined the Air Force, gone for 4 years. Now we're down to four guys and no lead singer. I mean, I'm an okay singer, but I'm certainly not Don Ciccone. He was a fabulous singer. So we just did the best we could. We went on a tour with the Dick Clark Where the Action Is show. That was right. A big show in the 60s. Dick Clark, it was a spinoff of American Bandstand. And in the middle of the tour, Jack, our drummer, comes down from our hotel. We're filming. We have a video that day with Dick Clark and let's see, Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Young Rascals and all these bands. We're all live on TV. And Jack comes down looking like his mother was shot. And I go, Jack, what's going on? He says, you're not going to believe what happened. I said, what? He says, I'm drafted. I went, oh, no, not another. And I said, all right, so when we get off tour, you're going to have to go. He says, what are you talking about? He says, I report tomorrow at Fort Dix. I said, what? And we're in the middle of the tour. And now we're dying. We have a guitar player, a bass player, and a piano player. And that's it. That's left of the Critters. And we have shows to do. We still have 10 more dates to do in this tour. Thankfully, BJ Thomas was on the tour. His drummer came up to us and said, listen, I've watched your show 15 times now. I can probably play it with my eyes closed. You want me to just take over? Thank God. And that's what we did. The draft eviscerated us. So, we never recovered.
Yeah. So how did from that and doing American Bandstand, which was kind of, I believe, you know, if you watch the program, kind of wholesome. I don't know what went on backstage. So how does the crazy, we've read about it in the book. So how does the crazy world of Arthur Brown come into your life then? Because I mean.
There you go. Well, there was a huge turnover. There were only two members of the band original by the time we ended, Kenny Gorica and myself, the bass player. And we added a gentleman named Paul Glanz. Now, Paul was just a wonderful keyboard player and a great singer. But eventually, I ended the Critters. I pulled the plug on it because we went from playing stadiums to playing high school proms. And no, I'm not doing that. I would rather be poor than irrelevant. And that's kind of what we were rendered to be. So, Paul and I remained friends. And he just called me one day. He says, hey, look, a gig came in for me, and they're looking for a bass player. Can you still play bass? And I said, of course. I play bass every day. And he says, what is it? And he says, You probably never heard of him, but he does have a number one record. I said, no. He goes, Arthur Brown. I said, oh my God, you're kidding me. Fire? He goes, yes. So there you go. I didn't even have to audition. He took Paul's word for it. And Paul said, look, this guy's had hit records. And Arthur was absolutely fine with that. And the real kicker, and I didn't even know it at the time, our drummer was Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Emerson, Lake & Palmer hadn't started yet, but and I didn't even realize that till I did the research for the book. He was just a drummer, nice guy. You know, we didn't really get to know each other that well on the tour. And, you know, I find out now, you know, what, 45, 50 years later, that's who was playing drums.
And I mean, you were still, obviously, you were still a young man on that tour. I mean, what was that like? Because he was quite a showman, quite eccentric, shall we say, quite extrovert.
It's completely nuts. I mean, people absolutely loved him. I mean, he had this persona of being like the earth representative of Satan. So, of course he was. And he was a showman, you know, he was just a joker, but a good one. And he had a seriously cool act. And I don't think anyone took him seriously, but man, he was good. He put on a show, he'd run around on the stage, he'd sung fire. I'll take you to burn. You know, he had this gruff kind of gnarly voice, and he would wear, you know, Catholic priest vestments, but not a cross on the front, a pentagram, you know, to just make it. I'll tell this story very briefly, but he also set his head on fire for the shows. They have a helmet that he wyrs, and it's got a kind of lyre harp shaped thing on the top of it. And they drown this thing in jelly gas.
Right. Yeah, I'm listening. Yeah. I'm just thinking about this helmet with, light, you know, flammable material on top, yeah.
Right. Then they light the thing off stage, and he runs off stage just as we're warming up to do the song, Fire, and he comes running out, and there's blazing flames coming out of his head. And it's very, very effective, and they got the crazy lights going on. So, you know, I knew he was going to do this, and I wasn't paying much attention, and Paul goes into the solo, and Arthur's running around doing his thing. I'm looking at Paul, and Arthur, in some dramatic move, grabs a helmet and throws it into the air. So this flaming, you know, flying barbecue is flying around, and it lands on the stage. Now, the idea is a stagehand will come out or something like that. I didn't see it land. And as Paul's playing, I just kind of backed up. I'm standing right over it. And, you know, I'm not quite commando in my little gown that I'm wearing, but let's just say I almost, you know, the Jerry Lee Lewis song, Great Balls of Fire.
Right.
So,
how did your friendship with Carly Simon start then? Had you come across her before? I mean, how did that all sort of gel and come together?
You know, just complete fate. After Arthur Brown finished his tour, he kind of disappeared off the thing. I never heard from him again. That was kind of it. And I needed a job. So I had known the last producer of the Critters was a guy named Dan Armstrong. He had a guitar store in New York City. So I called him up. I said, you need anybody at the store? He says, as a matter of fact, I do. I need a store manager. You want to do it? I said, great. Well, Dan's girlfriend was Carly Simon. And at the time, she was just a secretary. She had done some recording with her sister, Lucy, but she didn't have any hits. And she wasn't like a big star. She was just Carly, Dan's girlfriend. So we became very close friends, and she was, of course, a great singer. So we used to do jingles. We used to do soap and toilet paper commercials together. You know, we would just go into the studio as a pair and kind of duet these commercials. And we both went to the Juilliard School of Music briefly. And we just became great friends. And then one day she called me up and said, hey, I got a record deal. I said, whoa, congratulations. She said, you want to play on the record? I went, hell yeah. And that was it. It started there. I was on her first album, and I worked with her actively for 21 years. And we're still friends today. We still email back and forth. She did an endorsement on my book, as you probably saw on the back. She's the first one who said, you know, I love Jimmy, da da da, which I was incredibly grateful for. But that started a long, very, very successful relationship.
And I mean, what's it like to have a friend, to have somebody that you've worked with before, suddenly get the record? I mean, you know, you've got that yourself, but, you know, a good friend, somebody's girlfriend, and then they become, if you like, I mean, in the 70s was Carly Simon's decade, wasn't it, basically?
It absolutely was. I mean, the first reaction you might think would be jealousy, because I had hit records way before she did, but she really brought me along with her. I mean, when we performed, she wanted me right up parallel to her on stage. We didn't play behind her. I played next to her. You'll see it in any video that you look at. And the videos of the show we did at the Woman's Skating Week, the Schaefer Festival in the Park, that's on YouTube right now, you'll see I'm right up there playing bass right next to her. And so I never felt jealousy. She was so inclusive, and she's such a sweetheart. She's like the nicest person in the world. If you ever get to meet her, boy, you know, you'll be very, very impressed.
That would be definitely one off the bucket list to meet Carly Simon, I can assure you. Now, everybody's going to be asking, or everybody must have asked you about You're So Vain. I mean, it is, people go, you know, was it written about this? You know, it's apparently Mick Jagger singing the backing situation. And you lay down that absolutely brilliant guitar riff. What can you remember about the particular circumstances of recording that? Because it's such a great track.
Well, we did three versions of it, and the problem was drummers. We did the first version with Andy Newmark. Well, just to backtrack a little bit, the Anticipation album was one band. It was Paul Glanz, myself, and Andy Newmark. Paul, of course, from the Critters and Arthur Brown. And what happened was Carly said, I have to tour. Can you help me put a band together? And I said, well, I already have these guys that I work with. You want to just pull them in? And she said, absolutely. So they auditioned and everybody got along fine. Anyway, during You're So Vain, the first version, she brought Andy and I over to London to record, and she used Andy Newmark. It didn't work. Andy's a phenomenal drummer, but just a little bit different enough that Richard Perry, our producer, said, no, that's not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing something else. Trash that track. They brought in a new bass player. You know, nobody special, just Klaus Voormann. And he played bass. Carly played piano. I played guitar. And this other drummer, Barry D'Souza, very popular drummer in London, same deal. Barry had a great feel, but it wasn't the right feel. Richard had this really, really specific thing. So then we start the third track, and the drummer's there. I don't know him. I don't know him from a hole in the wall. And we do the track, and Richard said, finally, that's it. And he's all over this drum. He said, I want a tom-tom fill here, right here at this spot, and kick the drum, and really, really specific stuff. And this drummer is killing it. He's doing exactly what he should do. Well, the drummer was Jim Gordon. Now, I didn't know Jim Gordon at the time, so I introduced myself, and I said, I noticed the American accent, so you're not from London here. He says, no, I'm from L.A. And I said, what have you been up to? What brings you to London? He says, well, I'm on a break with my band. I said, oh, cool. What's your band? He goes, Derek and the Dominoes. I went, wait a minute. I said, what? What, did you play on Layla? He says, play on it. I wrote it. What are you talking about? Oh, my God. I honestly almost went into that Wayne's World. I am not worthy. So I got to play with the incredible Jim Gordon, whose resume is in a 5-point font, about 50 pages.
Yeah.
His just amazing. The end story of Jim Gordon didn't go so well, but do we tell that story?
I think we'll let people read that in the book. Exactly. Let's leave that.
Jim had a psychotic break, and he's not doing so well. We'll leave it at that.
What's it like? Because obviously your relationship with Carly goes on through the decades of the 80s with Let the River Run and all that.
Oh, right into the 90s.
Into the 90s. Excuse me. Yeah. But also you do other stuff, as it were. You play with, you know, Cat Stevens. You play with, Kiki D, Elton John, Andy Williams. I mean, such a broad church. Do you think that keeps you fresh because you're going into play different music styles? Or is it just a challenge that you wanted to do?
I'm not sure if I would use the word fresh, because I'm just a huge music fan, and I will listen to anything that's good music. And I don't care if it's rap, I don't care if it's pop or jazz. I can listen to Coltrane and I can listen to the Sex Pistols. You know, as long as it's music that has a commitment behind it, I'll call it a commitment. As long as the people aren't just phoning it in, if it's got feeling, I love it. I've recently become a huge fan of Taylor Swift. Now, Taylor, she's very, very far to the pop side if you look at her early stuff. But as you move forward and forward and forward, she got more and more hard-edged and whatever. And I've become a huge fan. But I also am a huge fan of classical music, and I needed to really listen to a lot of classical music because 20 years of my last career was spent scoring for TV, big orchestra stuff.
And so writing music. I mean, where do you start with that? I mean, scoring, because I mean, I flunked music at college. You know, my four-part contrapuntal harmony is to be desired. So how do you take, I mean, obviously you were at Juilliard, so I mean, I'm doing my way into all things.
Well, I didn't get my degree. I didn't get my degree from there, but I took some courses.
So how do you approach sort of scoring and, you know, with orchestra and get the nugget for something different all the time? Because I could probably do a melody for an orchestra, but that would be it in 50 years.
Harmony, I think you're born with harmony. One of my teachers said that, you know what, I'm going to teach you to play and to listen. If you want theory, go someplace else. What happens is Beethoven writes the song and then all the theorists come in and explain what he did. But Beethoven did not write it because of theory. So another, not a classical composer, but the trumpet player from the Bee Gees, a good friend of mine, Bill Purse was his name, said, look, just approach it like you used to approach Beatles songs. Remember how you listen to Beatles songs and you'd hear the chords and you'd figure them out? He says, an orchestra's no different. Just listen to the orchestra, listen very carefully for the instruments, listen to what they sound like, find out if you have to ask what that instrument is, ask. And he said, the harmony's no different than a Beatles song. You know, you just make the instruments do the harmonies instead of the voices. So I had a partner in a advertising company who was a good scorer, and he taught me some of the basics, and I learned it by the seat of my pants.
What was it like when you had an orchestra? You know, did you sit in and
scary as hell? Scary as freaking hell. My first experience with it wasn't my first experience, but my first experience with a real orchestra, the Utah Symphony, was to score the theme for NBC News. That job fell into my lap. You know, it's a long story, so I won't bother with it. But there I was, and we were in Utah, and there, you know, 60 musicians sitting in the room. And I had put the score in my computer program with synth instruments, samplers, actually. So I knew every single note in the track. I arranged and I put the whole thing in there. But then the pieces of paper go down on the music stands in front of real people. And it was fine. It did not sound as good as the MIDI version. And NBC said so. They said, well, what happened? I said, you asked for real instruments. Real instruments are a little sloppy. They don't play exactly in time like computers do. And they said, well, what do we do? And I said, you know what? When we mix it, I'll mix part of the thing I did in with the live stuff. And that really took care of it. But there was one incident on the session that made me go into a white-knuckled panic. The NBC rep who was there said, and what about the 10-second version for blah, blah, blah? It wasn't on the list of cues. Now, if it was just me and my synthesizer, yeah, I could throw something together, Patrick. There's 60 musicians out there. What am I going to go out there on a piece of paper and write the thing out? And I'm standing there going, well, and you don't dare say you didn't tell me to do that. You make him wrong, you'll never work again. He is always right. Oh, yeah, that version. And then the producer who hired me says, yeah, Jim, what are we doing? You know, you got that piece? Let's get that going. I go, okay, turn off the microphone out there. And I ran out to the conductor. I hired a conductor because I needed the phone. I said, what the F curse are we going to do here? And he says, all right, let me think about this. He says, if we take the 20-second version and tell them just jump from letter A to letter C, that'll take 6 seconds off of it. And he just did this math, and then he dictated to them, says, all right, we start at letter A, we go to letter B, then we skip C and go to letter D, but you only go halfway through D and then just finish on an ostinato note of D. And I said, you think that's kind of work? He said, I don't know. Let's just try it. So I got my stopwatch out. We did it. Thank God it worked, or I would have been in real big trouble. That was a night that I had a large whiskey.
So to say the least. Putting this all, why did you decide to put this all down in the book behind? And I love the title, by the way, because even though Carly Simon made you come up to the front, you know, just ship, yeah, you know.
So what was the question?
Why the book now? Do you think did you have the time because of what just happened, etc.?
Well, what happened was COVID-19. I had a band called the Hitmen, And we were doing great. We were doing 70 dates a year. And everyone in the band was like me. They were all very experienced studio musicians. Lee Shapiro, our musical director, was one of the Four Seasons. He, the one who put together Who Loves You and Oh, What a Night. And also, he was an amazing musician. Jerry Polk, she was our chairman. Jerry was the lead singer on Oh, What a Night. So that's the caliber of people in this band. And we actually won the first ever Road Warrior Award for the Musicians Hall of Fame. So it was a fantastic band. And then COVID happened and everything stopped. All our gigs moved to 2021, 2022. And Lee and I, who are, you know, we're not 30 years old anymore, just said, I think that's it, right? And I said, yep, we had a great 10-year run. Let's relax now. We've earned our retirement. Let's just enjoy. So we ended the band there. And then my son says to me, Dad, you got to write a book. I went, what? What are you talking about? And he says, every time I see you, I ask you a question. You have all these great stories. He says, put them in a book. I said, who is going to want to read this? This stuff in the 70s, the 80s. He says, every one of my friends will freak out. My son is 29 years old. He said, my friends eat this stuff up. So I started writing. And the stuff started to come back into my memory. And I keep really good calendars and diaries and stuff. So I went back to the 70s, started reading my calendars. Oh, that happened that day. Oh, I remember that. Yeah, this, da-da-da-da. Before you knew it, I had 350 pages. And my publisher said, it's too long. You got to take stuff out. So I had to kill about a third of the book. Ended up on the stuff. But that's what happened. Took about a year.
So if people want to find out, because I'm going to do the fatal thing and what we call crash the news. If people want to find out more about this book, which is called Behind the Autobiography of a Musical Shapeshifter, it's by Jimmy Ryan. Jimmy, I know that you've got social media. I know that you've got websites. Where can they find you?
Sure. You can find me, Jimmy Ryan on Facebook. I don't do Twitter. I do have an Instagram account. It's Jimmy Ryan Productions. I don't do much on that, you know. I'm getting used to doing it because I kind of have to now. But the Jimmy Ryan on Facebook, you'll find me there. My picture is with the guitar.
Yes.
You want the website?
Yes, please.
www.rampagemusic.com. Rampage, like somebody on a rampage, music.com. And that everything I've ever done is on that website.
It's including music. It's a brilliant website. It's a brilliant career thus far. Jimmy, enjoy your weekend. Loving the gold disc on the back of the wall behind us, by the way. Jimmy Ryan, thank you so much for your time today.
You're the man, Giles. Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.